This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Lou Olkowski, host of Love Me, a podcast about the messiness of human connection. We've got a brand new season coming your way this summer that will punch you right in the heart. A secret diary takes over a young woman's identity, and a toothless chihuahua saves her owner's life. Subscribe at cbc.ca/loveme or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Duncan McHugh, and this is a podcast from the May 26th edition of The Current. Hamdam, it's an app designed to help women in Iran track their menstrual cycles. It's not very different from period tracker apps available to women here in North America, except there's more to it. Hamdam was rolled out earlier this year, and besides its tracking function, it's doing some stealthy undercover work, too. It gives Iranian women information on sexual health, domestic abuse, and divorce, topics that are taboo in Iran. It's just one of the apps by a digital startup called Irancubator, which we'll hear more about in a moment. Sudeh Rod is the activist who came up with the idea for the Hamdam app. We've reached her in Oslo, Norway. Hello.
Hi.
Your app has been called a Trojan horse because it looks like a simple app for tracking your period, but there's more to it than that. Can you explain how it works?
True. I think when it comes to the women's health, many people think about periods and that's it. So that is why also Hamdam is called the Iranian or Persian period tracker. But it's not only the period tracker. Once you open the app, you're going to see one third of the screen related to everything about menstruation and periods, but there are also links to know more about the women's rights, about the domestic violence, about different pillars, let's say, of women's rights as an Iranian woman living there.
Why is it something you thought Iranian women needed?
Well, at first, I would love to have an application about women's rights because of my background. I've been activist, a feminist activist since like 10 years now. And it was like, yeah, today Iranians are not really going on the web, www, but they really need an app so that they would just push this button and then they would get everything I would tell them. And then later I realized that actually the sexual health part and sexual rights are so important in that context that I really needed to put that in. So during the journey from the idea to implementation, we learned a lot, and I did also. So that's why the Iranian women are really excited about having finally their own period tracker application, which is also their companion in their rights and also informing them about different laws and different, let's say, equipments that they can have to be able to live a little bit more equal in that country.
When it comes to menstrual cycles and sex education, what kind has been typically available to girls and women in Iran?
I should say, unfortunately, nothing. And if there is anything, that is so biased. So the sexual health and anything related to women's body is such a taboo. And we also see in different news that is coming out of Iran. There have been also religious police just pushing women to wear and cover their bodies as they want. So the control over women's body is so high that we can even see it in the streets and everywhere. What we have in Iran about sexual health and sexual education, it is really so limited. So women are really going to these workshops, let's say, just before they get their marriage. And that is something they have to learn to know how to give pleasure to their husbands and how to be a good woman. And there's nothing really said about the STDs. There's nothing really said about the contraceptions. I mean, these are maybe available in that country, in that culture, but the government is not really promoting these rights.
What about within families, though? I mean, between from woman to woman, is there talk or discussion about contraception or periods at all?
Well, it's a yes and a no. Many young people know about their sexual health at the first time they hear about it is with their friends of the same age. And then it's also the second-hand or third-hand information coming from someone else. I came out of Iran when I was only 10, and my mom those days was only like 30 in her 30s. And we never had such discussion. I mean, we still do live in Europe, but still the Iranian culture does not really let my mom to come and talk about these things openly to me. Now I'm 36. We still do not talk about periods and so on. So the person who could help me with that was my grandma. And this is also what she told me once she knew about the app and she heard about it. She was like, now you're going to be the grandma for so many little girls.
That's great. The grandma for an app grandma. So what kind of reaction are you getting from the women who are using the app?
Well, so far, all of them have been so positive and really heartwarming. I should say this is the only Iranian period tracker app available on the market, and it's for free. And when I say Iranian, it's not only translation of the application you might know about, but it's also equipped with the Iranian calendar, which is absolutely, I could say, difficult to implement. It's also the language we are using in Hamdam is really, really as if this was the companion, was the best friend, because Hamdam means companion. So I get a lot of positive feedbacks, not only about the period tracker part, but also about how we are raising awareness about domestic violence and we're putting a name of the things many women are already living under. So I got this message on Instagram that can be really crazy to get a feedback on Instagram that, thank you so much. Now I know that my partner was actually abusing me. I'm leaving him after so many years because I know now that this is not only the bruise on my physical body, but he left me also bruised on my mental body. This is what she said exactly.
Is it risky for women to use the app or to be caught using it in Iran?
The information in application are not banned inside the country. So no one can come say this. You are doing something wrong there. Of course, we're talking about the sexuality, but the language is such that anyone can use it. We did not use any picture, even for breast cancer check. We did not put any picture. So I explained exactly what they should do so that a girl of 13 years old somewhere in villages, if she's got the app, the parents do not tell her, oh, this is pornographic or this is something, the content you should not have access to. So it's one about the language and second about all the information women should have inside the country. And it's not against the regime. It's just giving them more access in a friendlier and more understandable language of what their rights are. So that is why I'm not really so far concerned about the app being banned. And it has not banned yet either.
Thanks for telling us about your app.
Thank you.
Sudet Rod is an activist and the founder of the Hamdam app. She lives in Paris, France, but we reached her in Oslo, Norway. The Hamdam app came out of the Irancubator project. It's a contest that asked activists to submit ideas for apps that could help create social change in Iran. Firouzeh Mahmoudi is the founder of Irancubator. She's also the executive director of United for Iran, a nonprofit based in San Francisco. She's in Berkeley, California. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
How does the Hamdam app fit into the broader goals of the Irancubator project?
So Irancubator project, as you mentioned, came through United for Iran, our nonprofit, where we work to improve civil liberties in Iran. And a few years ago, we decided that the sweet spot for making change in Iran is where technology meets civil liberties and civil society together to bring about change. So we launched Irancubator, which is a civic tech incubator where we work with civil society and activists to build technologies, mostly mobile apps, to be used in Iran for improving civil liberties.
What kind of apps have you launched this year and what do they do?
So there's a wide range of apps. One of them was Hamdan, of course. Other apps, one is called Sandure 96, or in English, essentially Ballot Box 2017. It's about informing voters, which was very useful prior to the presidential election that just took place last week.
It's been described as kind of a Tinder-style app for learning about the candidates. How does it work?
The Tinder portion has to do with the fact that you provide various categories for the users to survey, to do a survey. They swipe right or left, like Tinder. And then, based on what the categories that they, the decisions they've made or the choices they've made in the survey, the potential presidential candidates are ranked according. And the categories include politics, international politics, economics, culture, women's rights, civil liberties.
Why is that important in Iran?
It's important to have I think anywhere when individuals vote, one, it's important to have information on the candidates that are accurate and one can rank them up based on one's own personal beliefs. And all of it to be in one place, captured concisely and objectively.
You've also got an app that's a database of political prisoners. Can you tell me about that?
So that is less of an app. It's more of a website. It's called the Iran Prison Atlas. We started that project in 2011, and now it's constantly evolving. We're in version 4, I believe. The Iran Prison Atlas is a database of Iran's political prisoners, the prisons they are held in, and the judges that sentence them. And it's a very interactive, integrated database. So one can look at a profile of a political prisoner. Let's pick Narges Mohammadi, who's a prominent human rights defender who's serving a 10-year sentence currently for defending political prisoners. Or you can scroll down on her profile page and find her judge, the infamous Morisse, and go to his profile or her prison, Evin. Or one can zoom out to look at systematic patterns of abuse.
And is it crowdsourced?
No, it is not. We capture information from individuals and when people contact us and we look at that information and verify it. It's critical for this information to be 100% accurate, of course.
Who are you targeting with these apps?
So the database is different than the apps. I will respond with regards to the apps. So each, because the apps serve a wide range of groups in Iran, if you will, it's a citizens of Iran. And our hope with Iran Kibir has been not to only support Iran's human rights defenders and political prisoners, which is critical work, but also engage hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Iranians at the level of risk they want to take and in areas they are interested in. So with this app, we are working with various civil society members who, if you will, are owners of the app to empower them and support them in building these apps to continue their efforts. And the network that they have and the issue area indicate who we're working with. So one app may support Iran's 2.2 million drug users. One may work on specific categories of women, like we mentioned. One other woman-focused app, Taranj, has information on legal rights, right to custody, divorce, as well as information on physical abuse in marriage, and gives the woman an opportunity, let's say, to do a survey to see if they're in an abusive relationship. So depends on the app.
I'm wondering, have there been attempts by the Iranian government to block these apps? I mean, Twitter and Facebook are blocked by the Iranian government. How are they reacting to these apps?
That's a really good question, and we're regularly monitoring that. So in addition to building the app and ensuring adoption, which is always hard work for any tech team, for us, that's half of the work. A lot of the work focuses on thinking through if the app's going to potentially be blocked, if it's going to be tempered with bad data, potentially, depending on the app that may be relevant, and doing security audits and penetration testing for the more sensitive apps. We have been actually pleasantly surprised that most of the apps thus far have not been blocked by the government. We do have plans to mitigate that if that does happen. It's costly and it would require us to launch a new version of each app. But for now, that hasn't happened. And part of that is because the situation in Iran has shifted a bit. I would say overall, civil society in Iran has shifted to work more on civil liberties issues and not necessarily more sensitive targeted issues. And part of that has to do with Iranians being rightfully nervous looking at Syria and Iraq and wanting Iran to stay fairly stable. On the other hand, the government has also opened up a bit and allows certain level of activity to take place.
But activism is still rare in Iran. I mean, so how risky is it for Iranians to be using these apps?
Right. So for example, the app Taranj that we just launched, it was promoted by a center-right media outlet inside Iran called Khabar Online. So far, we haven't seen a lot of harassment for our apps. And you're right. Generally, targeted activism, what we consider activism, is not encouraged and fairly more rare these days in Iran. What we do have is what they call lifestyle activism.
Could anyone be in danger if they're found using the apps?
We don't think so. A lot of these apps are not as sensitive. And individuals who get stopped and just quickly, let's say, by the moral police on the streets, they may quickly look at the phone and let them go. If someone's going in and being imprisoned and they're going through all of their content, then I think they have a bigger issue. And we haven't seen it. We're not worried, although we do take all the precautions we can by doing audits and doing what we call security by design.
You're based in the U.S. now. Your colleagues are also Iranians who have left the country. Would you be able to do any of this work from within the country?
I think that would be much more difficult. I think the reason we can do this work from the outside is because we have the capacity and the security to do this work from the outside. It's not easy to fundraise. Anyone who runs a nonprofit knows that. And we're not going to prison for it from the outside. And we are able to do that, to build the capacity to do the work.
Well, thank you very much for sharing information about the project.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Firuzeh Mahmoudi is the executive director of United for Iran and the founder of the Irancubator Project. She was in Berkeley, California. Iran isn't the only place harnessing the power of technology to fuel civil society. Similar efforts are underway in Latin America, Africa, and parts of Asia. My next guest is warning against the potential dangers that could pose to activists. Alex Dunn knows all about the perks and perils of using technology to bring about social change. She's the executive director and co-founder of The Engine Room, an international organization that helps activists and organizations make the most of data and technology. She also sits on the Technology Advisory Council of Amnesty International. She joins us from London, England. Hello.
Hello.
What do you make of Irancubator?
I think it's a really important initiative. I think that the last question you asked around if it would be possible to do this kind of work from within Iran, I think is a really important question. And I think the response makes it clear that that wouldn't be possible. And these kinds of initiatives, I think, have a lot to offer. And it sounds like from the example of the Hamdan app, that it is facilitating conversations that otherwise might not take place, that are very important on issues that are otherwise seen as taboo.
Why is it important?
Which aspect?
In terms of allowing countries to have voice and citizens to have access to information that they might not be able to get.
I think it's a key part of being a citizen in a country to be able to both understand and access information about how your government and society works and doesn't work, and to be able to share your thoughts on that with friends, family, people in your villages, towns, cities, and across the country. So I think it's a key part of an informed citizenry that's able to hold their governments to account, and also for us to evolve as a society that can have tough conversations about difficult issues.
Well, what concerns do you have about apps like the one that we just heard about that are being used inside countries where the government could crack down on their use?
Yeah, I mean, I think given my line of work, it's probably clear that I think technology has a lot to offer. But I think being strategic about how we use technology to further positive social change means that we need to be reasonable about what we can expect from technology and to be aware of possible unintended consequences or risks that we expose ourselves and others to when we build things. The ethos of the technology industry is to sort of move fast and break things, but that operates under the assumption that breaking things won't cause harm. But as these sort of creations move out of the laboratory and into the homes of real people with real needs, when they break, it can cause harm. And I think that the failure of technology to deliver what it promises has sometimes really significant consequences. I don't think we should make choices for others about the risks that they're willing to take to secure their rights. But I think we need to consider risk carefully in how we design and disseminate new technology. I would say with the Hamdam app in particular, I could imagine quite easily a scenario where it does become synonymous with a women's rights app, and having it on your phone is no longer an innocuous app that no one has heard of, but rather a signal or a sign that you are more actively advocating for something that might get you in trouble and might put you in harm's way.
Are there any examples of where new technology backfired?
A lot. I think generally speaking, how we use technology sends signals about who we are. So if I'm using encrypted email, well, what do you have to hide? Or if I am downloading an app for domestic abuse victims, what does that say about my personal life? Or if I'm using an app like Grindr, what does that say about my sexuality and information that I might otherwise consider private? So I think the
Haystack app caused quite a concern. What happened there?
So the Haystack app was designed in 2009 and amid considerable hype was launched and beta tested within Iran. And the idea behind it and to great fanfare was that Iranian citizens could circumvent blocks on certain online content and not only access that content, but also hide the fact that they were accessing that content. And quite quickly after security researchers accessed the raw code of the application, it was clear very, very quickly that the application did not do what it said that it had done. But it was too late. One, Iranians were using the app. Two, the international community was wildly endorsing it. And three, it sort of perpetuated this issue, I think, within technology that the industry itself is built on hype. So to get your app to scale, you have to say it will do everything you can possibly imagine. And that while that might work in consumer markets and might not cause harm in commercial markets, it can cause serious harm when the stakes are this high.
The apps are often created in the West for use in other parts of the world. Does that raise any issues for you?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, the idea that effective solutions can be built by people who are not experiencing the problem it decreases the chances that we'll be building things that people can use to solve the problems that they face. But also it exacerbates an existing power dynamic where local communities are not in charge of the agenda of the solutions that are being built for them. That is not always the case in technology that's built in the West. There are many, many wonderful technology projects that incorporate the views and the advice and the involvement of local communities. But I think that divide both undermines the quality of these initiatives, and it also sort of makes problems worse.
How concerned are activists that it won't just be activists using them, but that governments are using the technology and apps to spy on their citizens?
I think it changes from context to context, but I think that there is what I'm seeing is a general trend that people are developing much more sensitivity and awareness to the way that their use of technology can be interpreted by state actors or actors like advertisers that have ulterior motives to using our data and information. And I think that over the next decade, we're going to see dramatic advances in data science capacity. And as we sort of sprint into the future with reckless abandon, it's hard to know how our data is going to be used to either influence us or even explicitly control us in the future.
You talk about the future. What kind of change do you hope is going to come out of the some of the innovations in technology?
I hope that we're able to use technology to better connect with colleagues, with communities, with friends, and that trend will increase, that increased connection across borders will result in projects that otherwise wouldn't have happened, and that will empower civil society to accomplish things and tackle problems that before now we haven't been able to because we've been living in our silos and in our sort of islands, for lack of a better word. And I think generally speaking that, you know, technology has the power to do things that we can't really anticipate. And I'm quite excited for that and seeing how all of that unfolds.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Alex Dunn is executive director and co-founder of The Engine Room and sits on the Technology Advisory Council of Amnesty International. She was in London, England. I'm Duncan McHugh. Jimmy Gwich, thank you for listening to the Friday edition of The Current.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.